Welcome to Love at First Science, the podcast designed to dig deep into neuroscience, the human body, and anatomy. My name is Celeste. I'm a physio and I teach anatomy to yoga teachers. And this podcast is an archive of the lessons I've learned along the way in my attempt to bring a more science-based approach into the yoga world. Just a quick reminder that I don't run any ads, so this podcast can only grow with your support. If you learned something new that you found useful, please do rate and review the podcast. And if you think the content can help someone get out of pain, improve their life, move without injuries, or even just feel more inspired, please share it with them. It would mean the absolute world to me, and you never know, we just might help elevate our community along the way. What's up, everyone? Today, we're going to be talking to world-renowned yoga teacher Adam Hustler. Adam is one of those yoga teachers that has built up an incredible name for himself. He's got this unbelievable fascination with anatomy. He's highly trained in meditation, and he has this beautiful anatomical approach when he starts teaching. And you can really tell he taps into many parts of his past experience, which, oh my goodness, how varied. He's attended law school. He's an ex-boxer. He's got a black belt in karate, and he's an ultramarathon runner. Guys, I'm skimming the surface. Let me give it over to Adam because he's got such a beautiful way of explaining things. And that's why I brought him onto Love at First Science. This episode has been broken up into two parts, and this is your part one. A really warm welcome to Love at First Science. And I'm so excited that we have the great yoga teacher who is world renowned, Adam Hustler, on the show today. Welcome, Adam.
I do. I forgot what your podcast was called then. And I thought you were going to say Love at First Sight. And I just thought, what have I signed up for? I forgot the name for a second.
And it's so funny you say that because that's how the name was born. I just couldn't figure out a good name for it. I was really struggling and I was in the shower. And that's always what all the good ideas come, I believe. And I was like, maybe I could do a play on words. And then Love at First Sight came into my head. And I'm like, I'm really into science. So maybe Love at First Science is a good one.
Nice.
But actually, on that topic, it's one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on the podcast, because you have got a very scientific approach to the way that you teach yoga. Listen, I know you're so much more than a yoga teacher, but let's start there. Can you just give us a brief rundown of all the amazing things that you've done that brought you to this place in your life?
Well, as in my history, yeah. So this was never the plan. Like, I never wanted to be a yoga teacher. And I don't advise anyone to do a teacher training because they want to be a teacher. I advise them to do a teacher training because they want to learn more about yoga and build their practice. And then if they end up being a teacher somehow along the way, wonderful. But yeah, so my background was law, supposed to be a lawyer, went to a top uni, studied law, ended up doing lots of charity work. Assumed that would be my career, like working in the nonprofit sector. But all the while at the side, I was doing lots of sports. So ultramarathons, marathons, boxing, rugby, martial arts, all of that was always happening. So I've always had an interest in the body. And yoga kind of crept in a little bit at uni, really as something to help with my boxing. Like, I found that when my muscle was looser and I was more mobile, I could hit harder and recover faster, which is not necessarily a good reason to do yoga in the first place, but it's a nice entry point. And then I kept doing yoga, ended up in Birmingham, which is where I'm from, working in the charity sector. And I wanted to meet people that I had something in common with, maybe meet a potential girlfriend, because I was in this city where I didn't really know anyone. Boxing wasn't going to help me do that. Working in the charity sector wasn't going to help me do that. So I thought I'll either do dance or actually take yoga a bit more seriously. And like, spoiler, I didn't meet a girlfriend doing yoga. I didn't speak to anyone. But I did find myself dealing with a quite stressful period in my life mentally through the help of yoga. And again, my boxing continued to get better. I recovered faster. So I guess initially yoga did have fairly profound physical and mental health benefits for me. And I just kept doing it. I did a training just to help me build my knowledge because I've been doing it for long enough and I wanted to learn more. Ended up teaching a few classes on the side. Got some opportunities straight away because I guess at that point in time, there weren't many yoga teachers like me. And in that sense, it was kind of sporty heterosexual males. Okay, there weren't that many yoga teachers of that niche 12 years ago. And so I kind of got a few opportunities and kind of, you know, mainly teaching a lot of sporty people. And somehow I ended up doing more and more yoga, more opportunities, ended up teaching at one point 26 classes a week whilst also working a full-time job. Like, obscene. Yeah.
That is one thing about you, is your work ethic. That's something that I observe from a distance. I'm always like, that guy can graft. Jesus.
So in that sense, I definitely was even more single. Yoga helped me become more single over that period of my life, because I was just working and doing yoga and teaching yoga. And then in terms of how I teach now, I think most teachers go through stages. Now, my first stage was teaching set sequences. Then it was very music-driven classes. Then it was like lots of classes where I taught things that looked impressive that I knew no one else could do. Then after a while, I realized I wanted to actually teach a more kind of anatomically informed style of yoga. And that is one little bit of advice I'd give to newer teachers. Don't rush and do loads of trainings too soon. Do a training, practice really teaching. Practice. Maybe teach 1,000 hours, see if you like it, see what kind of style you like, what you resonate with. And then at that point, get more knowledge. But I think the idea of doing like 600 hours of training in one go makes no sense. Like, it makes commercial sense for the studio selling you that training, but it doesn't make sense for the individual. So yeah, so I'd say, you know, maybe 9 years ago, I realized the style of yoga I wanted to teach. And I've been pretty much teaching an ever refining style of that since.
And Adam, something that I pick up, especially on the social media posts that you put out, is there's almost like a little bit of frustration that the yoga world in general just has this really extreme nature to it in terms of almost contortion, maybe getting into the fancy shapes, not frustration, more just like almost like a willingness to educate for people to think outside of that box.
Yeah, carry on.
And I guess one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, of course, your background. You did so many like really intense forms of training, for example, boxing and martial arts and ultra marathons. And I guess I wanted to understand from your point of view, mainly like how do you see yoga through a different lens now? Yeah. And maybe what some of the advice is that you can give to teachers who are still kind of in this frame of mind that, oh, it has to be about a fancy pose.
So I think there's many entry points to yoga. There are more people than ever doing yoga in the West, which is a wonderful thing. But for that many people to be accessing yoga, they needed a different thing to draw them in. When I started doing yoga, most people started because they'd had some kind of physical injury or emotional trauma in their life. And that's kind of why most people did it. Now, lots of people do yoga because it's in their gym, or because they want to make cool shapes, or because the cool crowd are doing it. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. And I think having these styles of yoga that bring people in initially is wonderful. But I would, you know, I would consider that to some degree to be like beginner's yoga. Like, being obsessed with the shape is beginner's yoga. Being obsessed with doing crazy stuff is beginner's yoga. Doing yoga with goats is cultural appropriation. you know, but I think these styles to some degree are beginner yoga, but they're a lovely access point. And you know, that drew me in to some degree at the beginning. I started to do like Budokan martial arts yoga. and like, I was like flowing into handstands and like one arm stuff. But so I think it's fine. So I'm not frustrated it exists. I more want to be a voice that's saying that it is other stuff as well. Yeah. And that, you know, if you can hold a handstand for 10 minutes, but you can't sit still for 10 minutes, then actually something needs to shift in your practice. Don't just do the thing that you're comfortable with. And this is, for me, on I guess a more kind of a mental health level, the main benefits of yoga. It makes you do something that is challenging, whether that is confronting the thoughts in your mind or holding a pose. And your job is to keep a steady breath and steady mind through that. And if you can keep that equanimity and that balance, then you can carry that forward to other parts of your life. From a physical perspective, I know I consider yoga to be a practice of balance. And so if someone is only focusing on extreme contortion-like poses and passive range of motion, that's not a practice of balance. That's a practice of extremes. There is no balance happening there. But having floppy joints is not desirable. We want control over them. So the people that are strong need to get more flexible, and the people that are flexible need to get stronger in certain areas. And when I talk to yoga to anyone, like an Uber driver, that's how can I describe it? It's a practice of balance, or as an antidote to life. Like, if you're an Uber driver and spend your life doing this and hunched over a wheel, then yoga from just a physical perspective could be a wonderful antidote to that and open up and open the chest and get into the pec minor. If you're a boxer like me and very asymmetrical, again, yoga is a wonderful chance to open. If you're a ballerina whose natural tendency is to point your foot and externally rotate and turn the pelvis when you lift your leg up, fine. But you don't need yoga to do more of that. Yeah. Actually, let's engage the adductors. Let's learn how to square and not let everything be a backbend. Let's find balance. Let's do the things that are challenging for us.
It's beautifully explained. I think that's one of the reasons I really enjoy listening to you talk, is because you're so succinct and so clear. And it's really, really good to listen to you say that. And I think another thing that I really wanted to kind of check in with you is sort of, what are you noticing in the students that are coming through, sort of the challenges that they're facing, and potentially how yoga can support them?
Cool. You know, being succinct isn't always useful commercially. If I end up teaching content that I could expand to 100 hours in 10 hours and sell it as a 10-hour program instead of 100 hours.
But you know what? Honestly, it's going to mean better word of mouth, because I very much appreciate a succinct teacher that can get to the point.
So the question there was about how is
what are you observing sort of in the yoga community, the students coming through your door? What are some of the challenges that they faced with that you think, actually, with the toolkit that I have as a yoga teacher, I can actually support them?
So for me, it's I feel that my duty in the yoga world is actually to help people that have had a long-term practice, and my job is to help reframe their practice. Now, I like teaching beginners, but it's not really my thing. I'm not that interested in that. I think other people can do it better than me with more passion than me. But I want to make people question why they do what they do. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's teachers, the way they teach yoga, or the teachers or experienced students and the way they practice yoga. I want people to come to it with an analytical mind to some degree. And that's what changed the yoga practice for me. Bringing in my lawyer's mind and asking, why am I doing this? Yeah. What is the reason behind automatically binding in a twisted lunge? Why is that my default? Yes, it looks cool, but is there any other benefit to doing that bind? And so that's my job, and that's what I love to do, is equip students with knowledge, not just do this thing because I said it. Okay, I'm not parroting phrases. I want to tell students why I'm saying what I am. And I'm not saying I'm always right, and I'm not saying there was only one way to do things, but every instructional cue I give has a reason. And I want to be a yoga educator, not a yoga instructor. And I think that's sometimes what's missing for many students, is they get told to do things without any explanation. And what they do is they just make shapes. And those shapes become ever dramatic or ever extravagant. But there's never a thought of, okay, what is the actual benefit of doing that particular movement in that particular way. So that's where I want to help people. I want to make sure people have questioned why they're doing it. But that extends to all parts of yoga practice or yoga teaching. It can be, why is my mind moving in this way? It can be a conversation I've been having a lot on trainings recently, is why do we use music in class? And do we want class to be fun? Or do we want class to be a practice of inquiry? No right answer, but it's important for people to have their answer why.
Yeah, to know
and that's
why.
That's not just teachers. I think students really benefit from that as well. And of course, you're not, as a teacher, I think it's important to find your niche, because we're not the only teacher in the village now. There's so many teachers. We can get away with finding our niche, and there'll be enough people that resonate us that we can make it a commercially viable venture to be a yoga teacher. So, of course, not everyone wants to know why and what they're doing with their external rotators in downward dog. But many people will want to know that at some point in their yoga journey.
Yeah, and then actually knowing that you actually have the tools to answer those questions, I think, is what's so great about what you do and how you share it. And the inquiry of asking why is so powerful, because what it does is it sort of shifts away from dogma and it being almost a guru culture, which I think has really damaged the yoga world. I think so many gurus have abused their power and many times didn't really know the answer to why, but kind of just spouted out stuff and then maybe turned a bit nasty if someone kept asking, and in making someone feel small, eliminated anyone else from seeking out that inquiry.
Yeah, no, completely agree. I think the whole idea of guru is not ideal. I think putting anyone on a pedestal is not ideal. You know, I don't want students to ever put me on a pedestal. I want them to acknowledge the fact that I probably know a little bit more than them about yoga, in that I've taught 10,000 classes. So do listen to me, but out of respect, I like to ensure I explain why. Yeah. And I'll get that in a class sometimes. You know, I'll get someone who clearly has a long-term practice, can do crazy shapes, quite resistant to what I'm saying. Like, they'll ignore me and like look at me in the eye and ignore me. But you know,
challenge.
I don't want an argument with them, but I want to make sure I'm explaining why. And normally they receive that really well, because I'm not just saying do this because I said so. Coming back to, let's say, the bind in the twisted lunge. Now, I might say, remember, at the start of class, I said we're working towards Kundinyasana A. Kundinyasana A is essentially revolved triangle on top of Chaturanga. What do we need in Chaturanga? External rotation in the arms. So why are you now doing an internal rotation?
Exactly.
When in this 60-minute class, limited time, we're working in this direction.
We don't have enough
direction.
Time to prepare, exactly.
To do everything. So let's make sure in this context, for me today, do this. And that's the kind of language I'd like to use, for me today. Not always and ever this is the right way, but for me today, let's do this.
Hey, my loves, real quick, if you are hypermobile, be sure to check out my book, Too Flexible to Feel Good, where my co-author and I share the latest science on how to help a bendy body feel awesome. If you already have the book, please do leave it an Amazon review. It helps more than you could ever know, and it just might help someone else feel a bit more stable in their bodies. The book is called Too Flexible to Feel Good, and you can get it from most online retailers. Yeah, and what's worked for me, and like that kind of humility in your approach, and also you're so right, like we haven't got a lot of time, and I personally really prepare my classes, and I feel like listening to what you're saying, you must put a level of thought behind each practice before you walk in, because otherwise you do go into that autopilot where you're like, oh well, we always bind in this pose, so we might as well just get people to bind here. But if you're thinking, oh no, we're building up to something, there has to be a bit of thought before that. And that takes preparation and time and effort.
And these questions come up a lot, because I teach a lot of CPDs for teachers. And that's a constant question that comes up. How do I deal with a person in class that says they're a teacher and then just does their own thing? Like, how do I deal with that when they're ignoring my instruction? And my advice to that is, number one, intro at the start of class, let there be an intro.
You do an intro.
It doesn't need to be long, but just so that people know that you've planned it. And if you're covering a class, the students that don't know you suddenly have more faith in you, because they can see you've planned it. The worst class for me to go to is one of the teachers says, what do you fancy doing today?
I'm the same. It's such a...
You haven't planned anything. You're just going to make stuff up as you go along. Like, top trumps, just picking out names of poses in any order.
It kills me.
That's a one approach, is tell people what you're going to be teaching at the beginning, and then gradually teach a skill or action at increasing levels of intensity through the class. So it's repetition. The best way to teach someone something is then they're looking at you. So in a tabletop position or a seated position, you can teach concepts and movement. Then when they're in downward dog, they've got something to refer back to, and you have as well. And then if someone keeps doing their own thing, sometimes I'll stop and go, right, guys, this is what we're going to be working on. Or I'll sometimes, if I'm in a bad mood, be like, guys, I've done 10,000 classes. I know what I'm doing. Trust me. Stay with me. Or I'm just like, I'm not insured for you to do whatever you want. Stay with me or you need to leave.
Oh, I love it. Listen, just going back quickly to the whole question of why, I feel like in the yoga world, people make up reasons on why to do things. And then these become perpetuated myths that are held as gospel truth. And I'll just give a couple of examples. I mean, relax your glutes in a back bend. You shouldn't go from internal to external rotation, otherwise it'll grind away your hip joint, shoulders away from ears. Like, there's a lot of myths kind of woven into the cueing that teachers do habitually. What are some myths that kind of really sort of weigh you down, and how do you approach it when you're kind of met with a challenging student who's like, but this is how I've been taught?
I think a lot of the myths, I think I can't even say that word in my list, can I? myths, kind of. a lot of those are more that lots of teachers have learned a script, or have learned that these are the instructions you give in this pose or in this movement. don't do this, do that, open your feet like the pages of a book in Baddha-Konasana. You know, we're not taught why, we just taught this is what you need to say. Mm-hmm. You know what? People often have asked me to do a book on cueing. Adam, your cues are really good. Can you do a book on cueing? And I don't want to, because my belief is all the cues are in front of you if you understand the pose. Just look mm-hmm. at the students and help them. Don't memorize a cue. Just take your cues from what you're seeing in front of you. So I think that's where a lot of these myths have come from, is people have done one training where they've been told this is what you need to say. And sometimes 5 years later, they're teaching their own trainings and just echoing that. And that is kind of the problem, is sometimes teachers leading trainings have only really done their first training in their first school, and suddenly they're teaching another generation, another generation, another generation of teachers. And I think that can be problematic. And yet my favorite teachers are the ones that change their mind a lot when presented totally with new agree. Evidence. So I think that's why these myths exist, because there's a lack of teaching on the initial training of why, which is kind of fair enough, because you can't do a lot in a 200-hour training. And there's just a lot of repeating and parroting without any kind of conversation on why. And of course, our understanding of the human body is always changing. So for you to be teaching accurately, you need to constantly stay on top of the research. Now, I just had a physio appointment with a wonderful guy in Surrey called Massimo Barcelona. He's like a very high level clinical physio in London, but his main practice in Surrey. And he was like, he's written like infinite papers. And the reason I went to him is I got a Lisfranc rupture on my foot about 7 years ago. And I want to start doing ultra marathons again. And I haven't run for like 7 years, but I want to start doing that, which is maybe like an early midlife crisis. but he showed me something that was published in the British Medical Journal last week about myths related to running. You know, I had this old adage, you know, running is more likely to lead to osteoarthritis development in the knee and hip. And it just isn't.
No.
The occurrence is more likely on people that are either static or professional level extreme runners. But for most runners, actually, you're decreasing the risk of osteoarthritis. So I think you that's a hard thing for teachers, is you need, if you are teaching a style of yoga where you need to be, you're giving very specific anatomical instruction, you need to stay to some degree up to date with the research. However, I don't want to scare teachers and say that every teacher you have to be reading the British Medical Journal. As long as you're not being super prescriptive and saying this is the only way to do this, and I'm going to use my body to force you into a shape that I think is correct. If you're just holding the space for people and letting people slightly adapt as they need, it's far better people do yoga with you than no yoga. But I think if you are teaching trainings or teaching a style where you are getting people into very specific positions, it is important to stay up to date. But if you're just teaching a general vinyasa flow class and you're letting people adapt, it's far better people do that than no yoga at all.
Absolutely. And I guess another thing that I wanted to ask you was a little bit about sort of what are certain things in yoga that you feel can really support people's day-to-day bodies? Because I know that obviously everyone is so different, and we've got people that are going to be things like you just mentioned, an ultra marathon runner. We may be going to have someone who's an ex-gymnast, but a lot of people, even people who do yoga, do lead very sedentary lives, and they do kind of fall into patterns with their movements. They kind of do the same thing over and over. Even, I mean, yoga's classic for this, right? We do so many of one type of movement. You know, what are some foundational concepts that you think need to be woven into classes to help support people's overall function?
I think firstly is balance. When I say that in this context, what I mean is people should try and identify what habitual patterns or shapes they make with their body. Like, I used to work with a hairdresser one-to-one, and he identified that he had quite like a leany stance, that he'd like bend one leg, his other hip would shoot out, always on one side, leaning around the head. And that was his standard pattern. I've talked about the Uber driver. I've talked about the boxer, who's quite asymmetrical, or just someone sitting at a desk slouching in fairly deep spinal flexion. It's working out at what are your habitual patterns. And if you practice yoga, you'll notice certain poses really seem to unlock some quite tight areas. So I'd say if you find areas that seem very tight or very weak, is work out what poses has the teacher taught And can you do more of that in your life? And like, if you need to do it while you're watching Netflix, fine. It's not a yoga practice then. It's just you're using yoga poses to help support your body. But I think that's quite important idea for people. Like, if you are an
self-inquiry.
Just finding out what you need. So if you're an ultramarathon runner and you're running, I don't know, 100 miles a week, let's say, just as part of your training, doing a vinyasa flow class where there is 10% of work stretching the legs and maybe, you know, 1% of that is actually getting into the gastrocnemius, then that's not enough because you're doing 100 miles. So you need to do a little bit more of that in your normal life. So I think from a physical perspective, that's what most people are going from. Doing a few styles of yoga, finding out what they seem to need more of, and doing a little bit of that in their free time. Okay.
And you've already beautifully alluded to it earlier, but I think it's a beautiful time to go into it now, because you mentioned that yoga is so much more than just the physical practice. Mm. And that actually through yoga, we can actually start to uncover, wow, actually exactly what you've just said about the body, but applied maybe to more your mind and where you're lacking in terms of that. How do you support people on that front, because it can be really uncomfortable to suddenly give yourself the space to sit still. I mean, it's really challenging.
Yeah, like, so when I teach yoga, normally it's a quiet room and there's lots of time for stillness, and that's a hard thing for many people. And this comes to meeting people where they're at. My style of yoga isn't good for everyone at every point in their yoga journey. A lot of people will need to start with like a hot room or loud music fun class to begin with. So that's what I'd say initially. I'm not a fan, in terms of, you know, the psychological benefit of yoga, of forcing people down a path. Like, I don't want to say to people, you know, close your eyes and imagine your childhood, just consider what trauma you might have gone through, and, you know, that's beyond my remit. And if that was something I was qualified to do, I definitely wouldn't be doing it in a class full of 40 people doing it in a one-to-one session.
I totally agree.
But what my belief is that I want to help people connect with something beyond themselves, maybe the universe, maybe God, whatever you want to call it. But the most tangible part of the universe we have access to is our physical bodies. And most of us are familiar with using our physical bodies. We're not familiar with meditation. We're not familiar with chanting or devotional yoga. But in the West, most people have some experience using their body.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the use of the body is a vehicle for self-inquiry. Okay, when you first start yoga, you are probably making shapes. And the main benefit that comes is probably stretching or strengthening. But, you know, I found the main benefit of a long-term yoga practice for me, you know, it's almost been 18 years, isn't that I have flexible hamstrings. If not, my hamstrings are probably tighter than they were 10 years ago. That's not the main benefit. The main benefit actually is when I'm faced with problems, whatever they might be, I can face them in a slightly more loving, calm, collected way and see things as they are. And it's through practicing that on the mat, like not being attached to shape, not being fixed on the sensation I'm feeling, being able to just stay calm through the challenging poses, I've been able to do that in life as well. So my way of teaching that is not through, let's say, explicit yoga philosophy, although that has value and it certainly informs what I'm saying, but I tend to say it in a more colloquial way, informed by both yoga philosophy and some of the Hellenistic philosophies as well. But you know, it's not through monologues. It's through just constant poking. And, you know, just and asking, like, God, what are you doing? Are you focusing on getting your elbows on the floor? And are you losing the integrity for the sake of depth?
Mm-hmm.
You know, these kind of conversations that come up in class quite naturally can help really facilitate that inquiry.
Thanks for listening. That was part one of the show. Next week, I'll be releasing part two. Remember, if this episode was helpful at all, please do share, rate, and review.